take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Bullet, bullet, pear, right, cherry, bomb, fillet, yum, bullet, bullet, pear, right, cherry, bomb, fillet.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your awkward high touch of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You holla back. You were just listening to NCT 127. That is Cherry Bomb. And NCT 127 was one of the groups that was playing at KCON last weekend, which I attended. And I know if I'm there, I know my man Jeff Benjamin is there. What's up, Jeff?
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast. First time. Jeff is a senior digital editor at Fuse and also, crucially, Billboard's K-pop columnist and also writing about K-pop for various other places. And best I can tell, the most knowledgeable person in the contiguous 48 about K-pop, who's not like a 13-year-old girl, basically.
Hopefully.
I mean, well, that's the job, right? So we were at KCON this past week, and we'll get to KCON later in the podcast, but I wanted to use this week's episode as an opportunity to kind of talk more broadly about K-pop, its history, its influence in the States, its current growth, where some of the opportunities for it are, and where some of the liabilities maybe are. And there's no better person to talk about that with than Jeff. So let's start off with some kind of big picture questions.
Yeah.
In the last 5 years, say, a thing that I've noticed is increasingly you're seeing a lot of big artists finally really beginning to tour in this country. What are the dynamics that have been changing that's allowing that to happen?
Yeah, I mean, we're actually coming right up to the 5-year anniversary of Gangnam Style, yep. Psy's Gangnam Style, mm-hmm. You know, everyone.
Shouts to Psy Twitter.
Shout out to Psy Twitter, indeed. And, you know, that, a lot of K-pop fans would argue that doesn't exactly represent the K-pop world in general, mm-hmm. but that was a huge breakout moment in terms of the last 5 years.
Because, in global awareness.
Yeah, because, you know, YouTube released this statistic even after the first year of Gangnam Style that I think it was, you know, pre-Psy, YouTube views of top K-pop acts were around like 2.2 billion. And after Psy, a year later, it grew to 7 billion. The viewership in the U.S. doubled. It had an effect whether you realized it or not. You know, the big picture is that also, you know, we don't have a chart topper like Psy. We don't have these acts and these groups breaking out in the same way that he did. But there's been an undeniable impact when you look at things that I think are actually a little more substantial when it comes to, like you said, touring, like you said, album sales, yep. and something like KCON, where its numbers are growing, you know, exponentially almost.
When I saw you on Saturday, we talked a little bit about album sales, U.S. album sales. Yeah. And a lot of times in terms of the Billboard world, is it the world album chart or the global? What is the chart that these albums appear on and how well are they doing? Because it seems like very well.
Billboard does count K-pop as world music. Yeah. It's considered one of those. And in that genre, I don't even think of it as a genre, to be honest.
Well, that's great. We want to have that conversation for sure. But and it certainly isn't the same genre as like Ladysmith, Black Mambazo.
Right. So. And I would say probably pre this sort of K-pop takeover. You saw a lot of Celtic music. A lot of that music was doing really, and it still tends to do well on those charts. Mm-hmm. But every week there's a new K-pop act, you know, doing quite well in these charts. You look at the World Digital Songs chart. That one's got a lot of K-pop, you know, always fluctuating in and out of it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, it's not even like these groups are moving tons and tons of records, you know, but at the same time,
in this country,
right. Exactly. But you are seeing, you know, significant growth. Just last year, this group BTS, they're probably the probably the biggest group at in the K-pop moment, right now, yeah. And especially when it comes to American representation. You might have seen that the Billboard Music Awards, sure. They took mm-hmm. home an award there. But they had the biggest first week sales of any K-pop album, 16,000 copies sold of Wings last mm-hmm. year. And that, I think, charted at number 26 on the Billboard 200. And that is, it's a significant amount of albums to move. Yeah. You know, it's not record-breaking in terms of U.S. artists or English-speaking artists, but a completely Korean album of a group that barely promoted even here. They didn't step a foot in America. This was all based on, you know, YouTube and people, mm-hmm. you know, talking and all
are,
that kind of
are
work.
Are any of those sales physical or they're all digital, you think?
I think it's mostly all digital, I would say.
Yeah, because that'd be streaming. My guess. Because also, like, I imagine the only physical retail places that are offering these albums are not, I mean, not that there's record stores left, because obviously no record stores, but there aren't, like, very many record stores that offer this. And even, like, at the KCON merch tables, you see one of the things I find so enjoyable about the physical releases is they're all different sizes.
Yes.
Even, like, an EP is, like, a deluxe book with 36 pages.
It's beautiful, filled with pages, and it's worth it, actually. I mean, lots of K-pop fans will buy the digital copy in addition to the physical copy, because it's actually worth it. It's filled with these beautiful photo pages. Every album comes with a member's card, and so you, like, always hope you get your favorite, and you trade if you don't get your favorite. It's so fun.
Speaking of BTS, let's listen to Dope. Yo, ladies and gentlemen, 준비가 됐다면 부르게, yeah. 다 녀석들과는 다르게, this style로, 네네네, this style로, yeah. 밤새 일했지, every day. 네가 클럽에서 노래, yeah. 잠을 낮지만 안 들었네. I got a feel, I got a feel, 난 좀 짜라. How long have you been writing about K-pop as heavily as you do now?
It was right around 2011. And, you know, really honestly, shout out to Billboard, because they were very open to this idea of Korean music and saw what was happening in Asia at the time. You know, it was really doing really well in Japan, started to, you know, gain interest in China and other territories like that. And the former editor, Bill Wordy, he was just really interested in it. And it was perfect timing for me. I was, you know, writing a couple things, but, you know, no one knew about this thing that was sort of, you know, gaining so much online traffic. And any writer, editor will tell you the K-pop fans come out of the woodwork to read anything about these groups or vote on anything.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, if they're in a poll, they'll automatically take it over. But I would say, it's been around since 2010, 2011, since I started.
And the striking thing, and I think this is why, you know, say Billboard was probably early on, is I feel like a lot of things when we think of, like, American subcultures, they tend to exist in the area of cool people are into it, but there's no data to back it up.
Right.
So it sort of takes a while to trickle to a data-based organization like Nielsen or Billboard.
Right.
Whereas with K-pop, I imagine the data was there maybe even earlier than traditional cool kid adoption, because you can see streams, you can see sales. Like, that's something, and that's obviously a flag for them, and they say, we want to be involved in this.
Yeah, and you know, these groups were selling, like, a remarkable amount of music in, like, Japan, which is the second biggest music market in the world. So something was already brewing, you know, even before they sort of started beginning to set their targets on America and things like that. You know, like, we saw certain groups try things out here and there, but every time it was this really, like, there were some, like, really key moments, like, really early on. Like, I think, you know, this K-pop star Rain in, like, the mid-2000s, he was winning Time's Person of the Year poll, you know, out of nowhere, like, beating, like, you know, presidential candidates and whatnot. You know, he was doing so, and everyone's like, what is that? Where is this, you know, K-pop star coming from? Or who are these groups that are beating Justin Bieber and One Direction and all these things? And it was those, like, aha moments that quickly kept happening, where it soon, began. The data just simply backed it up.
It's incontrovertible.
That there is an interest of this, but also an extreme passion, fanaticism behind it too.
Before we started recording, I asked you to pull together a list of some songs, sort of foundational K-pop records, or maybe more a quick tour through K-pop history. So this is something that I think is going to be useful for me as sort of a casual but curious observer, but I think also to our listeners who may not be totally fluent with this stuff.
Totally.
So I know you brought a list. What's the sort of most OG record on this list. Let's start at Patient Zero.
Right. So I think the perfect way to start is with Seo Taiji and the Boys. And I apologize if my pronunciation isn't perfect. But most followers would say this is the group that started K-pop. They were kind of the first group to really embrace this idea of mashing genres, mm-hmm. bringing different sounds together in a way that Korean music hadn't really seen at the time.
What year is this?
This is 1992.
Okay,
when they
so
debuted.
Quite a lot. So 25 years.
Yeah, no, it's been a while. And what's so funny is that they were a trio, and one of the members of the trio was Yang Hyun-suk, who's the creator of YG Entertainment.
So this,
see, who is a big
so this really is,
player. That's
this really
size
is
record
patient.
Label.
This yes. is big, yes.
So, you know, you'll hear it. You'll hear this kind of new jack swing hip-hop sound. Yeah, that kind of like blew everyone's mind and topped the charts for like weeks on end because everyone's like, this is just so, you know, so many different things, and they loved it. And
what's the name of the song?
This one's called I Know.
Okay, so let's listen to I Know by Seo Taiji and the Boys. Okay, so 25 years ago, Korean pop was beginning to do the thing that seems to have become something of a template or at least a foundational layer of bricks for
right.
what's happening today.
100%.
How fast did it happen after that album or after that song for everyone else to start playing the same game? Was it a quick transition or did it take a while?
It kind of took a couple of years because people were like, oh, this idea, you know, Seo Taiji was really good at bringing this idea of concepts. You always hear K-pop groups.
Yes.
They've sort of adopted this American word that it's a, you know, when they release a new album, it's a concept. They are either, they have a sexy concept, a strong concept, an innocent concept.
Same with Popcast.
Right, right.
Every week is a different concept.
Love it. This is our sexy concept.
Yes, always. Well, frankly, it's always a sexy concept.
But, you know, it was soon that companies realized that they could monetize this thing and they could, you know, manufacture this idea of, okay, we can make acts that can have these concepts. We can have different sounds. So, you know, by the late 90s, you were seeing a company like SM Entertainment, who are the biggest player of the Korean record labels. They're home to Girls' Generation, mm-hmm. if you've heard of them, EXO.
And they're still the biggest.
Still the biggest. Okay. Yeah. Right up there with YG Entertainment, mm-hmm. like we said, home to Psy. And then so soon enough, you started seeing these boy bands and these girl groups coming out with very specific looks, very specific sounds, very centralized, you know, ideas and concepts that they stuck to regardless of musical aspirations, whatever it might be. Because Seo Taiji found so much success doing everything from gangster rap to metal. Like mm-hmm. those are true musicians, those guys. And they really kind of went for all these different sounds. And Seo Taiji is still he's pretty active. He comes mm-hmm. back every now and then. They've since disbanded. Yang Hyun-suk is
the boys had enough.
The boys
are going out on their own.
The boys are out, yeah. But yeah, it really set this precedent for different groups, and every group needs to find their place in the industry, basically, and that comes with, like, you know, different concepts and different looks.
Mm-hmm. And so walk us then through the 90s into the later 90s and early 2000s. because at a certain point, I think for me, it was probably the early 2000s when I was really starting to be aware of the scale of what was happening.
Right.
And the diversity within the scene. What's happening at the dawn of the millennium?
Right. Well, that's the thing is that, you know, these boy bands and these girl groups that were being created by these companies, they were very much, you know, they kind of took this formula. They're like, okay, we can mash all these sounds. We can have them with their concepts. We can kind of take what Ciotaji was doing and kind of do it in like with these really attractive boys and these really like fun girls, you know, whatever it might be. And so you started seeing different groups kind of coming up and rivaling each other. And there's some like classic groups like H.O.T., Sex Keys, S.E.S., Finkel. These are some names that some old school, really old school K-pop fans are automatically know. These are the legendary groups. And yeah, just slowly but surely, you started seeing these groups kind of ride off the success of one another. And a lot of these groups, they didn't last for a long time. That was sort of, I don't know if it's even a drawback, but you know, a lot of these groups didn't, H.O.T., for example, I think they were the biggest thing. I think they were from 97 to 2001 or 2000, a humongous group. And they disbanded at the height of their popularity because they wanted to end on a high note rather than possibly get too old and, you know.
Pop like stars, let that be a lesson to you.
I mean, maybe it's not.
I can think of a few people who put out albums this year who probably should have went out on a high note, just FYI.
Right. But, you know, slowly, we saw them slowly, you know, making their ways across overseas territories. You know, every now and then there'd be a concert in whether it was Taiwan, you know, Japan, things like that. Slowly but surely, they were just trying to get the word out, just trying, you know, Korea, it's a small country when it comes to, you know, in Asia in general. It's quite small. We're talking about South Korea.
Right. There's no secret. Well, not that we know of, at least. There's no secret North Korean K-pop.
Not a huge fanaticism.
And it's worth briefly talking about the industry setup.
Yeah.
That was birthed and then subsequently birthed this big business.
Yeah.
Because there are different conglomerates.
Yeah. Exactly.
And they basically are machine. I mean, they seem rather machine-like in terms of how many groups they put out, the audition process.
Yes.
Give us the 60-second distillation.
I'm glad you brought that up because, like I was saying, the companies started trying to manufacture sort of this idea, right? So they recruit kids, young kids who have aspirations to be musicians or performers, and they train them for quite a while. You know, it's like that old school media training mentality that you don't really see in America these days. But they house them, they feed them, they train them, they go to school, and then they go and practice at these agencies. They call them agencies, not even really record labels, but they train them for everything from singing to dancing to acting to speaking other languages. And slowly but surely, they come together and they realize the best fit for this person. They decide if they're going to be in a boy band, girl group, if they're going to be a soloist. And and the idea is that when you debut, you're perfect. You're ready to go. And you can only get better from that. You know, they really want to showcase a good look from the start.
How many agencies right now are I imagine there's endless agencies, but how many are really relevant?
I would say there's probably 15, you know, all that are really up there. They have at least, you know, one or two big acts, you know, really kind of competing with one another. And that's a crazy thing too, is that people become fans of these agencies too.
Which is the thing I've noticed. Yeah.
Right. These groups, you know, these agencies started having aesthetics and looks to them, and you start becoming just fans of, it really became this like branding system of being like, you know, we're going to create this new group. You know our brand. You trust our brand. We've given you stuff you like in the past.
Yeah,
look forward to
what's
next.
Which is not that different from, you know, Def Jam in the 80s or, you know, Interscope in the 90s.
They're just really outward with it. I think it's kind of unfortunate that a lot of K-pop gets called sort of this factory. There was this really, you know, controversial in the K-pop community story in the New Yorker. I think it was around 2011 about Girls' Generation. It was titled Factory Girls. And, but, you know, interesting title.
Shouts to the copy editor who wrote that title.
But, you know, I just think they're just a little more upfront about how manufactured it is. And, you know,
whereas we in this country are probably almost as committed to the manufacturing process, but also even more committed to obscuring it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
fair point.
Yes.
Fair point. All totally fair. All right, so walk us through the next kind of breakthrough record.
So this thing was kind of growing, right? This idea of, you know, how can we make the perfect groups? Everyone has a concept, everyone has a look. And then there was kind of like this breakthrough moment where everyone thought, okay, maybe this could actually work in America. And I would argue it would be Wonder Girls with Nobody. This was a 2008 single, huge hit in Korea. Wonder Girls were a five-member girl group under JYP Entertainment. Wonder Girls probably their biggest success internationally, but they've had a lot of popular acts like 2PM and GOT7 and twice we saw KCON this weekend. And Wonder Girl's whole thing was retro styling. So they could do anything from 80s music to brassy 60s, 70s music. Mm-hmm. And nobody was very much in that Motown-y type of sound. And it was just this really catchy song, did really well in Korea, went viral, huge viral hit. And then they recorded in a couple different languages, recorded it in English, and somehow it took off in America. It charted number 76 on the Billboard Hot 100, and they did a couple TV appearances. They were at the time managed by the Jonas Brothers, same manager.
Oh, really?
They got a touring spot. You know, a couple things were working out really well in their favor. Mm-hmm. They performed on Wendy Williams. It's a hilarious clip.
We gotta find that. Seen
Wendy Williams hug these small girls.
Oh, that's hella funny.
It's amazing. They performed on So You Think You Can Dance. They had a lot of good media looks for them. And that's when this group, they kind of, you know, took some time to actually spend in America, learn the customs more. They were living here. Didn't totally work out. Mm-hmm. But I do think this song is just one of, like, such a fun, great K-pop song.
All right, so let's listen to the Wonder Girls' Nobody, the Billboard chart sort of hit of 2008.
Why can't we just be like this? Because it's you that I need and nothing else until the end. Who else can never make me feel the way I feel when I'm with you? No one will let go.
Okay, so this record and this group brings up one sort of recurring motif in K-pop, which is almost like a squeaky clean, ultra-feminine aesthetic that kind of runs through. Like, yeah, you don't see it really in, like, 21, but you do see it in a lot of other groups. What's the sort of origin of that, and why is that so prominent? And does it kind of go in and out of favor?
Just being like ultra feminine and I mean, I think, you know, it's so interesting when you see kind of what works in Korea and what doesn't work.
We were talking about this. You mentioned about wondering if Twice was going to be as impactful here as it would be there.
Right, because there's this idea, at least right now in Korea, it's very trendy to have this very innocent image right now. Mm-hmm. They've kind of, you know, there was sort of a badass era for a little bit. There was the 21, like you mentioned, groups like 4 Minute, After School, Kara, they were kind of showing like a sexier side, more powerful side. And you saw that kind of, you know, more hip hop leaning sounds. And then something happened and it sort of reverted a little back recently where, you know, sort of the innocent, fresh, you know, very, very feminine, very girly type of concept started to reappear more and more. And you saw that, you see that recently. And you know, the classic example of this is Girls' Generation, who became the biggest thing when Wonder Girls kind of shipped off to America a little bit. That kind of set the stage for Girls' Generation to rise up. And just a year later, this is the next song I wanted to bring up. They released G, which is thought of as the quintessential K-pop song. It's so, you'll hear it in a second, it's so hooky, so quintessentially like K-pop. Like, you'll hear it and it just is so effervescent in that way that you're just like, this would never work in any place other than, you know, Korea. But at the same time, it did work everywhere else. You know, it worked in Japan. I would say it's a really well-known hit in America because for the longest time, G was the top viewed K-pop music video pre-Psy. I think it had like 74 million hits before Psy kind of took off.
Let's listen to G by Girls' Generation.
Let's go!
Okay, so another thing about Girls' Generation is Girls' Generation had a U.S. record deal.
Yes.
Girls' Generation was signed, don't know how long, but they were signed to Interscope.
They were.
And I remember getting those emails from Interscope from a bunch of clueless people who didn't understand what they were working.
You know, that's such an interesting moment, because that was kind of seen as the next step, right? Okay, yeah, great. They have a huge record label. This was everyone knew it was Lady Gaga's label at the time, Black Eyed Peas' label. And yeah, and I kind of look back on that time. It was very exciting, right? But at the same time, I look back on it and I was kind of like, oh, that wasn't really, it wasn't a good representation of them, because Girls' Generation, like I was saying, they were known for being very bubbly, could create, you know, hook after hook. And then they released the first song with Interscope after the U.S. deal was this sort of, and I, you know, these fans are going to hate me for this, but I thought
you got to look the stands right in the face. And tell them truth.
It was, you know, it was a song called The Boys, released in 2011. Yes. And it was kind of awkward, you know, that these girls, they were saying, the English version, the line is, because we get it in, you know, the girls bring the boys out. And Girls' Generation never talked about getting it in or bringing boys out. They, in fact, you know, most of the time Girls' Generation was shy around the boys. They that was sort of their
thing. That was the thing. That was the shtick.
Which is kind of how a lot of those groups tend to operate. You know, it's very much in this sort of innocent world, which is great and fun for everyone. You know?
Yeah, there is a real hermetic kind of women on one side and men on the other side. Like, are there, unless, I'm sure there are, maybe I haven't seen them, are there male and female group together?
There have been, and they haven't done very well.
Yeah.
Lots of times, there's this idea that, you know, the co-ed groups are going to either date one another or it's not going to work. We're seeing this one very exciting group, their name's CARD, K-A-R-D. Mm. They are co-ed. They've seemed to have some traction, at least in America. They've already held like 3 concerts in America, and I heard they did pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious to see how they do, because they're just focusing more on trendy sounds rather than, you know, trying to be this whole, we like each other, you like each other. But, I mean, even in America, we never really liked co-ed groups.
No,
either.
Of course.
Pop
it
groups.
The femininity of the girl groups the sort of masculinity of the male groups feel very intense.
Exactly.
In both directions.
Yeah.
Creating, in my mind, because a much broader gap between those two things.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So let's listen to some CARD. Jeff, what song should we play for the people?
I think their first song, they called it a pre-debut song. This is the first song they ever released. It's called Oh Na Na. I think it's really interesting. It's really fun. I say we start with that one.
Let's get it in. We'll be back in a sec.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Okay, I'm cheating. I know your final song is a YG Entertainment song.
Yes,
and YG has, I think, been in the last 5 years very important, not just because of Psy, but in terms of Big Bang and offshoots, and 21 and offshoots, in terms of translatability, especially to like cool kids, and, heavy quotes, but still. And I think especially videos have been huge in terms of translation. So which Big Bang song did you pick?
So I chose Fantastic Baby.
And that's an early-ish Big Bang song?
I'd probably say mid.
Okay.
You know, this is when they really started really adopting the EDM, electronic, you know, really blending that world into it. They had it before, but this is really, really them, I felt like. And it kind of set the stage for, you know, sort of their, a lot of international interest. And this right now is the most viewed non-Psy K-pop video. So the top viewed K-pop video by any group, I would say.
So let's listen to Fantastic Baby by Big Bang.
Wow, Fantastic Baby. Dance. I wanna dance, 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 dance. Fantastic Baby. Dance. I wanna dance, 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 dance. Wow, Fantastic Baby.
이 난장판에 급한 왕차례 땅을 흔들고 3분으로 충분한 break. 분위기는 wire, catch me on fire. 진짜가 나타나.
하나부터 열까지 모든 게 다 한 수위. 모래 벌판 위를 미친 듯이 뛰어봐도 거뜬한 우리. 하늘은 충분히 너무나.
So here's where I want to start talking about aesthetics. And you said earlier that you think K-pop is not a genre, which I think, or maybe that's, is not a genre, which I'm super open to as a concept.
Yeah.
Okay. So when I write about K-pop and I listen to, you know, as much as I feasibly can, given that I also have to listen to Kelsey Ballerini and whatnot, who I love, but it makes me think a lot about pastiche in terms of somewhere between massaging and slapping together potentially competing styles. Makes me think a lot about that four-letter word, appropriation.
Sure.
Which apparently there was a panel on cultural appropriation in KCON.
It's awesome that even KCON would.
I agree. I was very, very surprised to see it. But also I thought it was a little sus they put it on 11 in the morning on a Saturday. I think that tells you how they really felt about it.
Yeah.
So I think about appropriation. I think about pastiche. But I also think, like, in America, if you think of the peak boy band periods, you know, your sort of Backstreet Boys, recent peak boy band, not like New Kids era, whatever, New Edition or whatnot. There's this sort of internal anxiety, I think, in American boy band culture of how sweet can it be? And at the other fringe, it can't be also too tough.
Right.
And so I think it discourages aesthetic risk. I think you end up with groups who have big hits, but they tend to be within a rather narrow band. NSYNC sort of pushed against that a little bit, and certainly Justin Solo did that. But I feel like it ends up in a narrow band. I'm always very struck at the kind of volcanic intensity of these young boy bands and girl groups, more so the boy bands, I think. And I wonder about the development of that aesthetic, and I wonder about how they're perceived internally in the Korean marketplace. Is it perceived as sort of a mainstream avant-garde? Is it perceived as toothless pop? How is it taken there?
Boy bands are, in Korea, you debut a boy band because they're going to give you album sales, they're going to give you touring tickets and merchandise in that way. And the girl groups are more so about being trendy and, you know, making sure you can get commercial deals and endorsement deals in that way. But the boy bands are really sort of there to get as much interest when it comes to their touring, I would say, and the album sales. externally too, the boy bands tended to, you know, you see very few girl groups tour in America, for example, but you see a lot of boy bands, even if it's at the, you know, sort of smaller venues here in America, it's worth it for them to bring out, you know, 2,000, 5,000 fans. Yeah.
And as far as how it's perceived internally in the country, like, say when the Backstreet Boys were famous, I don't think anybody ever thought that they were musical innovators.
Right.
But when I look at Big Bang,
yeah,
I feel musical. Like I said, it feels like a mainstream avant-garde to me. And I wonder if that framing is the same framing as it would be perceived in the country, or is that purely like an outsider lens that I'm applying to it?
I don't. It's interesting because, like, technically, you know, it is their pop music, right? And it's you know, I always say, you know, these groups, they are like the Justin Biebers and the Selena Gomez's, or, you know, Ariana Grande's, whatever, of Korea and Asia, essentially. But at the same time, it's so interesting, I think, to us as outsiders, because it is this, in my opinion, very artistic, genre shifting, you know, shape shifting,
yeah, high degree of difficulty, creativity stuff,
right?
And that I think American pop stars of a similar vein are avoiding,
yes,
for the because it's maybe too alienating or too dissonant or too pastiche or whatnot,
right?
But when I see that that's the centrist pop music of that country,
yes,
that makes me excited.
I think, you know, and that's actually why I was drawn to just the music in general, like as a fan, first and foremost, of just lots of different styles of music. But, you know, it's this idea, I think, that, and I think this is where the K-pop agencies are going with, is that they wanted to create, you know, the most polished, perfect product. And I think that also relates to the music. You know, it's not just the groups and how that looks and how it's also how it sounds, the actual music itself. You know, we think of a boy band as a singing group, right?
Yes.
But most groups, they have the
rappers,
big vocalist, the rapper, the main dancer. There might be someone with a quirky, you know, talent who can do flips on stage. It's things like that where it's not, it really is trying to be a 360 deal of entertainment, and it's trying to be, you know, give you everything you might need. Instead of recruiting a rapper, we have a rapper in our group already.
And also, everything is malleable, everything is polymorphous, because a lot of times the singer is the rapper, and then the rapper becomes the singer.
I
remember when I first was encountering groups like this, I was like, oh, there's a guy who just only raps, and then I would see that person also sings, and the main singing guy would then just randomly rap once on track four or whatnot. And also, that's true in the visual presentation. One day, this guy has his hair dyed pink, and the other guy is dyed green, and then the next day, it's flipped.
100%.
It's constant cycling.
Exactly, and you know, if one sound isn't really working out for a group, they'll try something a bit new, and they'll say, okay, this worked, you know, now we're this group, you know, and it's, you know, they're just sort of upfront about it. They're like, oh, this is more us now, but you know, they kind of choose these very vague terms to sort of describe, you know, what works, but it's business in the end, you know, of course.
So let's talk about K-pop as genre or non-genre. What are your thoughts?
I'm very hesitant to call it a genre because strictly, you know, even because of how the music sounds, but also because I really don't think people are just fans of the music itself. I think lots of times when you inevitably, and this is what kind of got me drawn in and helped me become like a writer who specializes in this, is that it's not just about the song, because then you want to watch the music video and then you want to watch the live performances. But K-pop live performances are a little different. They have these music chart shows that they battle each other on, and they always want to win number one on the shows. So then you're like, oh, like, what are these different groups that are battling against them? And then you start like watching, there's these variety shows that they appear on, and then you know, you start looking at the album tracks, and you see the album packaging, and you start slowly but surely getting into this whole, it's a very different world. You know, the way they release music, it's very atypical. They typically they announce an album like 2 weeks before it comes out.
Yeah, and it's a sort of steady trickle.
Yes, exactly, of content.
And it's like, here's two songs, here's six songs.
Yes.
It's actually sort of how I would think in the streaming era, a genuine American star should be releasing music.
Well, I was even...
Instead of building up for 18 months and then dropping 12 songs.
Right. This is kind of almost what I saw with the new Jay-Z album. When didn't that get announced last week, two weeks ago, and it's coming out the 30th? You know, I was like, oh, this is so K-pop of him, like as a joke to
my
friend.
That's funny.
But, you know, he's like, he's just kind of keeping this excitement like really high. And
he's going to sign a bunch of people in Rock Nation now. You're just ruining the whole thing.
But, you know, it's it's that idea that they, you know, K-pop, they know it's like a very fickle market. Pop music is very fickle. So they want to keep your attention as much as possible, which is why they kind of keep this stream of content coming, you know, teaser photos, snip song snippets, whatever it might be. Then they release, typically, they release the music video, the single, the album all at once with the idea that it'll shoot up to the charts. It's success if it has longevity.
Right.
So that's why I think you also see so much on the Billboard charts too, because we kind of have to operate in that same way.
Right.
Is that you'll see these groups debut high, and but it really falls off quite quickly. Most groups, if they do chart an album on the Billboard 200, and it's only been a handful of artists, mm-hmm. they fall off typically in the second or third week.
And which is very digital era.
Oh, yes. 100%.
You know, it's very, it's viral before viral. Like, it's all that stuff.
Streaming's been huge in Korea for a while. And, you know, downloads cost like 3 cents in Korea.
Seriously? Yeah. Oh, damn.
It's not.
Shouts to Korean Spotify.
Right, right. But the albums are like really expensive.
Well, yeah, yes. The costs of production alone on those packages are really intense. So at KCON, the headliner on Saturday night, I was unable to go on Friday, but Saturday night headliner was CN Blue. And CN Blue is the most established of the groups. It was Attention played, Twice played, NCT 127, and CN Blue were the headliners. CN Blue is nothing like those other groups.
No.
And so when you were originally saying K-pop's not a genre, I took CN Blue's success as indicative of that because it's still somehow under the umbrella,
right.
But it doesn't sound or behave anything like that.
Exactly, right. And those guys operate in that exact same world, to give a bit of context, that's not perfect, but they are kind of like Korea's Maroon 5. They play instruments.
Yeah.
They write their own music. They're K-pop
rock. They wear expensive
rock.
Clothes. They wear very expensive clothes. Right? Very beautiful shirt.
Right. Very beautiful shirt.
Oh my God.
You tweeted about that shirt.
I did. Oh yeah. Seriously. Someone's stylist needs to holler at me. Yeah, sure.
Love it. But they, you know, they also tried a lot of different sounds. I really like CN Blue for you know, you probably heard it too. They had almost like a Can't Stop was like this sort of Coldplay pop rock jam. But they also, their most recent single Between Us is sort of electronic rock. They went through a lot of different styles, which I really like. And that's, they still operate in that same world. They go on the variety shows. They go on the music programs. The members act. The members have solo songs. They all operate very much in that same world, even though this group's a little different in the sense that they write, they compose their own music, they play instruments. But at the same time, they're still K-pop.
Yeah.
Know? And they still like go by the different, you know, different tropes of going to be a K-pop star.
So let's listen to CN Blue song. Let's listen to Can't Stop.
하루에 한 번만 그댄 떠올려줘요 Miss you 하루에 한 번만 나는 잊어볼게요 그것도 안 돼요 그것도 안 돼요 그것도 안 되면
When I think about the pastiche of these, the sort of, especially like the YG groups and the YG influence groups, I hear something new created out of the bones that have been provided by American pop and American R&B and American hip hop. And I think that took a while for me to hear, 8 to 10 years ago. But I think certainly in the last 5 years, it's very clear. How do you feel it's perceived internally in the country and in the industry? Does it seem to them that they are creating a new form from these component parts, or is it still sort of in dialogue with slash response to what's happening in America?
I don't really think it's exactly observed or taken in as, you know, we're mashing all these genres. It's sort of like they bring something new every time. And, you know, I almost feel like it's almost like the standard. You're 100% right that they really are trying to mash not only all these different genres to create something interesting, but it's to have that mass appeal, right?
Yes.
It's to have, you know, their whole point is to not only just be in Korea. They want to make it an international thing. They brag all the time about their YouTube views, about, you know, who has the most views and how many hours and how long it took them to hit 1 million mm-hmm. views. And it's that kind of styling that, you know, really sort of plays to, you know, how much can we get people to take interest in this, and whether that's in Korea, whether that's around the world.
Intriguingly, by using all these sort of reference points,
right,
it sort of serves as kind of like a universal sign language to go back out in the world.
100%.
And that's what's so just because I really just want to hear it, let's listen to Crayon by G-Dragon. Money, I get put it by swash, swash. Money, I get put it by swash, swash. Ajeekdo gulliji yana, yes, I'm a pretty boy. Na na la danya so fly, galati boy. What was smoking soin? I'm papa, opa, na ba bad boy. I'm a G to the D, golden. Diamonds, boy, 누가 아니네. You know I'm busy. 오늘의 DJ 나는 철이 너는 me. Hey, 아가씨, 아가씨, 난 순결한 지영씨. 이리 와봐요, 위험해. 네 남자 친구 지몸이 너 맞지, 다 맞지. 내 이상형 속에 미소. 김태희와 김미소. Oh my God, 전지현. Why so serious? Catch a crayon.
Yes, I too am a pretty boy.
Good one. I love that song.
So it's been interesting to see GD and to a slightly lesser degree CL from
right,
21
right.
be kind of like refracted back into American, or at least this country, if not the pop industry in yeah. this country. One thing I was very struck by at KCON was the diversity of yes. the American fans.
Oh, totally.
Because
awesome, right?
you have obviously a huge contingent of Korean Americans and other Asian Americans, mm-hmm. but I feel like the second biggest group were young Black girls.
Yes.
Who were like ages maybe 13 to 17.
Yeah, a huge Black population.
Very,
sure.
very striking. How aware is the K-pop industry? How aware are they of that fan base? And do you feel like, are they catering in some way? Do you think part of the universal language being like, we have all these reference points that are going to be familiar to consumers mm-hmm. of American R&B and hip hop helps ensure that the American fan base is as diverse as it is?
You know, what's interesting too is that, you know, most studies would say, you know, the biggest fan base, not even a majority, but the biggest fan base will be Asian Americans, mm-hmm. but they'll say the second one is actually Latinos, which
oh,
is
interesting.
You saw a lot of that also yeah. at KCON, but that's one of the my favorite things to show people when they, you know, someone who wouldn't know is that they say, oh, this is so diverse. I assumed it would, you know, whatever it would be Koreans, mm-hmm. you know, even though it's a very small portion of the population in America. But it's true. I really do believe that, you know, this music, and I liken K-pop a lot to other music scenes that also have very, you know, intense, passionate underground fan base, kind of like Latin music, which is huge. People don't even realize how huge it is,
yeah.
or punk pop or something like that, that aren't necessarily topping the charts, although Despacito is saying something different.
Yes.
But you know, but I would argue, you know, most Latin music fans at least are speaking the language or have an understanding of the language. I don't think a lot of K-pop fans speak Korean
no.
at all. Or,
although they were definitely singing along.
They
They're
know the
definitely
way.
I mean, rapping along.
We can definitely like pretend,
yeah.
you know, but that's the thing is that just like you were saying, there's a lot of touch points that are very accessible to a non-native speaker.
K-pop has not yet had that genuine cross-cultural conversation breakthrough hit. And it, I mean, look, it's very striking that it took a Spanish and English language song until 2017 to top the Billboard charts.
Right.
That's bizarre. But obviously it happens because there's a huge Spanish language population in this country. However, I think there's more simpatico with Korean pop music and American pop and hip hop music that I'm surprised that you do not see collaborations of that nature on American releases. They may happen in Korea. Do they happen in Korea?
Not really. I mean, you see producers.
What's good?
So I think about this a lot, right? This is like sort of my bread and butter, you
yeah.
know? Or if this happens, it'd be great for my career.
Okay.
But
Jeff needs more work.
But no, I love what I do. But yeah, no, it's interesting, right? Because they're two very different industries. Like I was like talking about, you know, Korea is very, you know how we created the global music release date on Friday? Yeah. Korea was like, okay, great. We're not going to do that. They release everything on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, or Thursdays, Mondays, Sundays, whenever really they want. It's not really they don't really play by these rules exactly that a lot of the rest of the music industry does. And also at the same time, they are very set in their, you know, it's done so well for them in Asia. Why would they change? But, you know, it's very much this idea of that, you know, releasing all the music at once, putting out the single and the album. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of things.
So you think
like
it's their obstacle?
Well, so at the same time, when they have tried to come over here and make things happen, I think it's been quite unfortunate and awkward, because like Wonder Girls, like I mentioned, you know, had literally a charting hit, a great manager, great representation in the U.S. They took a while to come out with what was supposed to be, you know, that English song that was supposed to take over. And this was in 2012. They released Like Money featuring Akon, who, if you look at the time, Akon had not had a hit in years in America. And it just sounded, it was very dated. You know, all the pieces worked. They're like, oh, we're going to release an English song and it has this sort of electronic feel and it has Akon, so it should work, right? And they have some success in America, it should work, but that's not how it works. I think we need something like Despacito, where you saw Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee, who had that song was a hit before Bieber jumped on it.
And they both have, they're not newcomers.
No,
they have
right.
built-in fan bases already.
Right. There just needs to be that's very smart collaboration where it just is natural and it feels right. And I think it's coming. Kanye West was on a song with a group called JYJ. And that song didn't go anywhere because I don't think it felt natural. I don't think Kanye was really on board to really, you know, go the extra mile for JYJ. But at the same time, you know, BTS has done really well by simply doing what they do. They haven't released any English music as a group. They haven't released any, you know, they've done the best so far, at least when it comes to charts and album sales, strictly by doing what they do well in Korea.
A thing that I am struck by is how hot and fast a lot of these acts burn. And especially even the biggest acts, it's very, very hard to be a globally successful touring act with a huge international fan base if you're moving that hot and fast. And also in Korea, there is mandatory military service where people start getting plucked out, often at the peak of their fame. This is going to happen with GD next, I guess, later this year or next year. Yeah, it's happened with Top already. And when I think about the conditions for a hit of the nature of Despacito, I think it will most likely have to come from someone who's incredibly established in the Korean world and then added with someone from the American world. And I get concerned that the careers that are being built in the K-pop world aren't long enough to build up that kind of potentially global loyalty to create that level of impact on an American chart. Maybe that's not important, but at least for the exercise, that's what it makes me think.
For a while, K-pop had sort of a 5-year expiration date. Mm-hmm. Now, I think with the international success of a lot of groups, it's sort of now become a 7-year. It's right now a lot of groups are suffering from the 7-year curse. Mm. CNBLUE, I actually asked them about it in my interview with them, and they said, you know, I think they're a bit different, but they said they want to keep going strong, mm-hmm. even though, you know, which I think indicates that whenever they go to the military, whenever these group, you know, it's 4 guys, mm-hmm. You know, they will eventually come back together. But a lot of
that's three years later, four years later. I mean, they're, you know, they're grandpas.
They're K-pop grandpas. Yeah. No, I mean, it's really tough and you really don't see it really happen a lot because, like, for example, there is sort of one group, basically, their name is Shinhwa, and they mm-hmm. kind of are the longest running K-pop boy band or K-pop group, I think, out there right now. And they went in their military service and they kind of came back and they do well. They can sell tours. They performed at KCON Los Angeles last year, mm-hmm. something like that. And, you know, they have hit songs, but it's certainly not the level that Big Bang or BTS or EXO mm-hmm. are at. So it's really tough, right? Same thing with the girls even. Like, it's this idea that, you know, like I was saying, a lot of girl groups are focused on, they make their money through endorsement deals and making sure they're the trendy girl group there. And yeah, you know, how long can you endorse schoolgirl uniforms. You know, it's a little tough. Yeah. So I do actually see some like positive changes in that way, because we're seeing a lot more musicality coming from these artists, mm-hmm. more and more groups. It's becoming like a media play point at this point. It's not going to be a random group that eventually right. breaks out here. You know, a lot of people,
unless it's sort of passes as a novelty song, yeah. unless it's a Psy thing. But no,
Psy was way established too.
Right.
In
I mean,
huge
in terms of American frame. I mean,
yes, exactly. And you know, a lot of people saw this girl group. Their name was Crayon Pop. They had a very big viral hit in Korea. They got the touring. I think they were under Sony or something like that, or had a deal with Sony. Mm-hmm. And Lady Gaga brought them on her Art Pop tour, but they weren't even very big in Korea at the time. They kind of had this viral hit song that kind of came out of nowhere. So it didn't exactly translate in America. And, you know, we don't really hear about Korean pop anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, someone like 21, who really had that established point in America. And I remember seeing a lot of fans being like, they should have brought 21. Like mm-hmm. that connection would have made sense. Both very avant-garde artists, very visually oriented artists, very artists that were blending a lot of genres at the time.
The thing that I'm always struck by mm-hmm. is that more American, in the way that K-pop stars seem to want to be appreciated and admired in America. Right. I'm always surprised that more American stars don't see the value in being a presence in that marketplace.
Right. And I do think it's a very provincial viewpoint. You know, Asia is this huge potential market that, you know, it does. So, you know, like I always, you know, Japan is the second biggest music market in the world, mm-hmm. but we tend to not really care about that because we're the biggest,
right.
but it still is this huge thing, and K-pop stars do really well over there. It's changed a little bit, but they're doing so well in China. K-pop has a really big presence in Latin America.
Yeah, you
South
did a
America.
Piece for the magazine about I did. Was it BTS in Chile?
BTS in Chile. Yeah.
Okay. So my fantasy baseball is BTS and Justin Bieber. Produced by Skrillex and Diplo.
Oh my God, perfect. Yes.
So that's my fantasy baseball. Now I've spoken into the world. Someone go handle that.
I'm telling you.
Someone go do that. Yes. It's an order.
If you heard their song, Blood, Sweat, and Tears,
that's,
do you know
what
that song?
That's what we're going
to It sounds like a Major Lazer. I think I actually wrote
You're
a review.
Reading
of,
my mind.
Exactly.
That is what I'm going to go out on. So we are going to close out this week's podcast with BTS, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Thank you to my guest, Jeff Benjamin, for coming and laying down the knowledge and the law on K-pop in America. I appreciate it. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us. I got an email from a guy. I don't know if he's listening. He said he was in his 70s. He said he had two favorite pop groups. I can't remember the one was, but the other one was Big Bang.
Oh, wow.
So shouts to you. Shouts to you for that email. And if you have a favorite K-pop group, email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. Next week, we will be on vacation like sensible people who work too hard. And then we'll be back the following week.